Broadcasting to New York City, Los Angeles, Chicago, Sydney, London, and around the world, this is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio Live on Trumpet Radio 101.3, KPCG, KPCG.fm online as well. This is the weekend edition. Some new reports are out about the labor force, participation, and the economy. We'll have some information about that. Also, talk about immigration. One town is saying no to immigration. We'll see more about that. And also, what are some of the worst songs of all time? There's a list from some writers into the New York Post. We'll see if you agree with that or not. That and more, this edition of Trump Radio Live.
This is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on this weekend edition of Trumpet Radio Live. We're at 101.3 KPCG. We're online at kpcg.fm. Live link at thetrumpet.com as well. If you'd like to follow us on Twitter, please do so at kpcgfm. And you can send us comments, questions, concerns, statistics, whatever you like, pictographs to comments at kpcg.fm. I'd love to get a pictograph. I'm Dwight Falk. Grant Turgeon's here with us today as well. We've been talking a little bit of sports lately with the World Series and such, but now we're shifting our attention to basketball, where it belongs. And Thunder didn't do so well the other night against Golden State. A little bit of a rough one, but just one game.
Yeah, that's fine. Whatever.
Grant's a diehard Thunder guy, so he's got a lot of emotion in the games here. But yeah, always interesting to see those games, and the media loves it when there's some, you know, rivalries and that they can sell their tickets. So
it's just kind of pathetic when he's staring down the whole Thunder bench and talking smack the whole game and just like posing and all this stuff. You left for the best team in the league already, and now you're just gonna show up your old team that did nothing wrong to you ever in 8 years.
You know, it's always funny when you watch sports today. You know, people have always, you know, celebrated and been excited about doing well, but it's interesting. You see it in football, you see it in basketball, where it can be like the first play or an inconsequential play, you know, just at the beginning of the game. You got to take 5 minutes to pose and stare at everybody, and it's like, yeah, this is moving along here. Get the game going a little bit.
It's unbelievable how much self-control some of those athletes have whenever they're getting, they're getting shown up like that,
yeah.
And it's amazing that they don't retaliate ever, it seems like.
Yeah, they do have to have a lot of restraint. Of course, back in the 80s and 90s, sometimes there wasn't as much restraint. I remember,
yeah.
But that kind of kept things in line too, because if a guy did that, there would be some retaliation.
Well, can you imagine being talked to and acted toward like that, like the way he was treating the Thunder players last night, and not doing anything to him?
Well, can you imagine coming into your average work day and having to deal with that?
Someone just getting in your face and scowling.
Yes,
ridiculous stuff.
Because they filed a better report than you or something. Giving you the stare down and the pose, yeah, that'd be.
Well, Russell Westbrook was pretty funny because he came in there with an orange vest that said "official photographer" on it. I don't know if you saw that.
Oh, huh.
But Durant is apparently an avid photographer in his free time.
Oh,
so Westbrook is always doing these funny things to sort of bug him.
Oh boy, well, it's good for the NBA. Get people interested in the.
It's nice to finally see a rivalry.
Yeah.
And you should. I don't know if you saw the video, but it scanned down the Thunder bench when Durant was talking to them, and every one of them was just making dead eye contact.
Yeah.
They're just straight stone faced, and then Cantor just wouldn't stop talking to him.
Yeah,
that was the cool part.
I did read a little bit about that. So he's not gonna be intimidated. He's from Turkey.
Yeah, it's a little bit. I'm just kind of confused because Durant was trying to say all these things about how he loved Russell Westbrook so much and that they're still brothers and how he has nothing but fond memories of being in Oklahoma City. But then it all comes out how he actually feels when they're on the court together.
Maybe he was softening him up for the blow. He was playing mind games.
Hey, he might have been. That's probably a pretty smart move.
Could
but
be.
None of the players shook hands before or after the game. So it's finally a rivalry instead of guys being buddy-buddy all the time.
Hopefully the Thunder can can play well enough to make it, you know, a rivalry of the court, because clearly Golden State's got four All-Stars, so it's tough to play that. But
Thunder had just played the night before. Mm-hmm. They had just played a really physical game against the LA Clippers, and they won that game.
Yeah.
But and then they won the first quarter last night, but I think they really just ran out of steam. So
yeah, that can happen.
That was a lot of it.
Does happen. You get tired out, for sure. There's some new reports out about the economy, and the big number, I guess, that's always interesting to me is how many people are not in the labor force, and it's 94,609,000 not in the labor force, according to CNS News. It says the labor force participation rate dropped a tenth of a point to 62.8%. In other words, 62.8% of non-institutionalized civilian population over the age of 16 is either employed or actively looking for work, while the other 37.2% is not working or even looking. So I guess if you factor in those that are looking, that would change the numbers a bit there too. So there's quite a few that really aren't working right now. Population is, what, roughly 320 million, give or take?
A little over 330, I would think.
330 now, yeah.
Maybe 340.
Yeah, yeah. It's growing in lots of ways, but almost a third, a little less than that, not in the labor force. So not great there. There's different numbers you can look at. Some make the economy look a little better. Some make it look worse. They always look at the unemployment rate, but that's kind of not really a fair indicator, I don't think, because you have almost 100 million that aren't even bothering anymore. So that's a huge number.
Yeah, it really does. It probably does weigh down the entire country when so many people aren't really contributing in the labor force. It's what people need is something to fill their days and really to contribute to society and then earn money that way. We have too many entitlement programs in this country that probably eliminate that element of desperation for people who don't have work right now.
Well, that's true, and it is always good that there is a little bit of a safety net, but if that safety net becomes a lifestyle, that's where the problem is, because like you say, if you have that fear of if I don't, you know, produce something, I'm not going to eat, you know, people will get busy pretty quickly, I would think.
Yeah, and I would think probably it's in the millions, the number of people who take advantage of that system.
Yeah. So that's interesting numbers there. Of course, we all remember the riots that happened in Baltimore. What is that, a couple years back already?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's been a few.
It's at least a year and a half or so. I think it might have been last April, maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe.
So much has happened, it's hard to keep
it. Maybe it's 2.5 years ago. I don't know.
It's been a while.
Yeah.
But there's a man that got caught cutting a fire hose that they were using to try to put out the fires, and he's got to pay $1 million restitution for cutting the hose, which is interesting because I'm sure he doesn't have it, so I don't know exactly how that works, but that's the penalty anyway. Sometimes people go out and they riot and they run around and they think there's no repercussions, but sometimes there are if they catch you. It says a man who pleaded guilty to puncturing a fire hose being used during the riots in Baltimore last year has been ordered to pay $1 million in restitution. That's where you tell the judge, like, nah, I don't have it, though. I got like $5. 22-year-old Gregory Lee Butler Jr., also known as Greg Bailey. How come he can have two names? How come people have multiple names?
It just makes me jealous.
The aliases, you know, known as AKA. Does somebody have to assign that to you to make your own? I'm never clear on the AKAs.
Also known as, I mean, is that what your friends at the barber shop call you, or do you have an official second name? That's always a bit confusing.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes people are trying to hide their identity, and that's why they do it, but usually it's a cooler name. I don't think Greg Bailey's all that cool of a name, but anyway, that's beside the point. He's ordered to serve 3 years of probation and to perform 250 hours of community service. The Baltimore Sun reported that the government sought a 33-month prison sentence. U.S. District Judge Frederick Motz also sentenced Butler to time served on Thursday. Prosecutors say Butler twice punctured a fire hose as firefighters were battling an arson blaze at a CVS drugstore on April 27, 2015. So I think we all remember that footage of that CVS going up and, you know, the big fire and everything. So the firefighters are trying to do their job and put out the fire, and you got this guy over there puncturing the hose. So anyway, I'm glad he got caught. Maybe that'll be a lesson to people.
It's nice to finally see people getting convicted of crimes for these riots, because I was starting to get the impression that you could just get away with whatever you wanted to do. At least this guy got caught. And at first I thought maybe the amount that he was asked to pay or ordered to pay was a bit much. But when you think about a fire hose putting out fires in a bunch of different buildings, it could have really caused that much damage at least.
Oh, sure. Yeah, burning a CVS down and you know, all the merchandise inside and so forth. That would add up pretty quickly. So anyway, that's one guy at least that's going to have to pay the price for that.
Yeah, definitely wasn't a million-dollar hose by itself.
Right.
But when you consider the other things that were damaged because you can't put out a fire, that really does add up.
Right. It was made out of pure gold. It was one of those rare. The Financial Times has this write-up here about Uber. I think I've asked you before. Have you taken an Uber?
I took it a few times when I was up in Seattle.
Right. I never have. The whole thing just, I'm a little on edge about Uber.
Yeah, it's weird.
It's, I mean, somebody driving their car.
It's probably better to take a cab just because they're actual professionals.
Yeah.
And not just driving their own personal car in their free time.
Yeah. I think I'd be more nervous as the driver as opposed to the rider. The ride, I could see doing that.
Yeah.
But driving and not knowing who you're going to pick up, that to me would be a little more unsettling. But some people do it, and probably some like it. But they say Uber, they want to get more into your life. Uber no longer wants to just deliver you or your dinner from point A to point B. Its new app aims to become an integral part of your daily life, including anticipating where you want to go, telling you where your friends are. That'd be sad if you didn't have any. And suggesting things you may want to eat. So I don't know. I think I'm good. Uber, I'm good. I don't need you to tell me what I might want to eat today. I think I figured that out.
Yeah, it's almost like technology is trying to get into the business of reading our minds, which would probably make most people uncomfortable based on what they're thinking at a given time. But, I mean, you see even with a web page opening up and then ads of things that you've recently searched being there, I don't particularly like that feature of most websites whenever you pull them up.
Yeah,
I mean, I don't want people who happen to see my computer screen knowing that I searched for a pink bicycle recently, and then that comes up on the screen. It's a little bit embarrassing.
Have you, has that, you know, that direct marketing ever worked for you where it popped at something up that you'd looked at a while ago and you went and actually purchased it?
Yes, but the way I look at it is it ended up costing me money. I mean, I'm not usually overly thrilled by the purchases I make because of those ads, but it is definitely effective.
Yeah, I think that's happened to me a time or two as well, where I looked at something and was like, ah, and then, you
might
know,
as well.
A week later, I'm like, oh, yeah, I mean, that's right. I was thinking about that. So it's effective, I guess. So anyway, they say the voluntary service here is likely to raise privacy concerns given its potential access to a large amount of data on its users. And that's kind of what they're worried about, besides just maybe it being too invasive personally. They're worried about where the data is going to go and that the data is going to get stolen.
Mm-hmm. I always also get suspicious when an app asks to use my location.
Right.
When it has nothing to do with me traveling somewhere or going anywhere. It just seems like that's a little bit much usually. And I mean, really, that probably is a subtle way of just gathering data on all the users.
Yeah, well, I mean, they know where you are, or your phone is, at least. Gus Hosen, he's executive director of Privacy International, he says, this is not a company that has a strong record on privacy, and now they want to behave more like Google, which is worrying. They're going to become an intelligence company, a mining company, and all our data will end up in the U.S., which has no strong privacy laws. So people are maybe a little bit concerned there about Uber getting all of their information. And yeah, I don't know. I'll have to check that off my bucket list someday. It's not in the bucket right now, but take an Uber.
It's pretty interesting because I've met people from probably 10 different countries in just the few times I took an Uber. They're usually from different places in Africa or like Eastern Europe. So pretty interesting, or even South America or Central America. I've met a bunch of different people.
So yeah, so you the driver or just other people?
The driver.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, interesting.
It is possible on Uber to get a car with random strangers as your fellow passengers, but I think the one driver as a stranger is enough for me to handle.
Yeah, you can't hand stranger danger.
a little bit too much if you're in a car full of strangers as well.
Yeah, too many strangers. The New York Post asked its readers a question, very important question: what are the worst songs of all time? And of course, usually it's pop songs. Those are the songs people know. They're not talking about symphonies. But it is kind of interesting to see the list. I didn't note all of them, but some of these. I think these will be familiar to most people on some level, especially if you're from the 80s or 90s or the 2000s, and that's kind of your era. This is no particular order. The readers of the New York Post thought these are some of the worst songs ever written in the history of their lives. Starship, We Built This City on Rock and Roll. Agree, disagree?
Well, I'm not going to say I'm a huge fan of rock and roll, but I don't really see why it's such an offensive song or a deplorable song.
I just thought it was catchy. When I was in grade school, they used to play that on the bus on the radio. We used to hear that song. Two interesting facts about that song. One, there's one version of it where there's a DJ that's talking like he's on the air in the song. And that's an actual guy. I think he was out in San Francisco. It was a DJ that actually was on the air out there. And so he was kind of immortalized in the Starship song. The other thing is, years ago, when I was working at a different radio station, we had to go to different events and promote them. And we went to this one county fair, which is kind of a small thing, but a lot of people came out to it. And they get old bands that no one else is interested in anymore. So lo and behold, who's there that day was Starship. And so they told me, they're like, well, you got to go out there with some guys and stand at the booth, and Starship's going to be playing. And I thought, well, whatever. I didn't think much of it. But you know what was funny? I knew every single song they did. I was like, how do I know all these songs? But I did. And they were actually really good as far as, I mean, the genre of what they were playing. And but there was only one original guy. And he was like in the back, like on the keyboards or something. Like everybody else was different than the original band. And so that's what happens when bands get older. They go to the fairs, I guess.
It's strange whenever the band keeps the same name and pretends to be the same group whenever four of the five or five out of the six guys are all different now.
Yeah, it is weird. And they, I guess if you keep the same singer, it works. But in this case, it was even a different guy, I guess.
Well, the keyboardist was the only one.
Yeah. Yeah, I wonder if he was back there steaming. Like, this isn't the way we used to do it in the real Starship.
It's been a mutiny in his own band.
Yeah. Another song that people really dislike. This one was very popular. USA for Africa, We Are the World. Remember when all the musicians got together and they did that charity event and they sang We Are the World for, I think it was
we
to help.
We are the children.
There you go. Perfect.
That's a great song.
Yeah, I don't know. People don't
like
it. I think these are songs that became very popular and people got sick of hearing them.
That's probably true, because that song almost could bring tears to your eyes.
I have to admit that I did go back and watch the video for that. And when I was looking at this list, and it's just like a who's who of 1980s pop personalities. You got Michael Jackson, you got Kenny Rogers, you got Bob Dylan in there.
Wow.
You got everybody taking their turn. And it's kind of funny if you watch the video, because it looks like Willie Nelson isn't sure what the lyrics are. He's kind of walking up and to the mic, and he's not quite saying the right thing. And
so they're all taking turns?
They're all taking turns. Okay. That's kind of the famous video for that. And then, of course, Michael Jackson was the big star of the day, so when he's about to sing, they start out with a shot of his socks, because he had, like, glittery socks, and they pan up, and he's got, like, the one glove on. And no one stopped to ask, like, you know, hey, what's with the glove?
Just one glove.
Just one, and it was sparkly. So that was when he was still popular and hadn't dipped into the, like, that's a strange guy, you know, territory. So, but I thought it was ironic. Here they're singing about, you know, saving people in Africa from starvation, and he's wearing like $10,000 socks. So
there's
whatever they call
it. There's a way to save them. Donate your socks.
Donate your socks to charity. So, yeah, that's kind of a who's who of stars back in the day. Kind of interesting. I felt bad for the ones that can't really sing. Because there's some that are pretty good, and then you get like Bob Dylan stepping up there, and everyone's probably like, oh, what's going to happen? He just kind of talked in his Dylan-esque, his Dylan-esque way. Another song people didn't like anymore, Bobby McFerrin, Don't Worry, Be Happy. Hmm. That was a kind of a feel-good song. I've never been upset with that one.
Is it the fault of all those fish plaques that wiggle and and the fish sings whenever you push the button?
Yeah, I think it's oversaturation for all these. That's why people are mad at them now. Another one people don't like is the band Berlin, Take My Breath Away. That was from Top Gun, I believe. So that's I one of those where if you hear it, you'd be like, oh, yeah, that's what that song is. So I don't know. People don't like that one either. Here's one that's a little more recent that people really don't like. The Baja Men, Who Let the Dogs Out? It's a question that still has not been answered.
We're still searching for the culprit all these years later.
I know nothing about that song other than that refrain, that line, and I don't even know where. I think I've heard it at like sporting events or something. It's one of those that kind of lives in like the world of sporting events. And it's like Welcome to the Jungle. Everybody knows the first 30 seconds of that song from every sporting event ever, and it just lives on.
Yeah, I can see why people will get sick of that. It's hard to understand what they're saying outside of the "Who Let the Dogs Out" part because they're singing so quickly.
Maybe they couldn't come up with anything, so they just mumbled.
Maybe there aren't any words. Maybe you're right.
Well, I have to admit that this song does come to mind often enough because if we're driving through the neighborhood or somewhere and there's a bunch of dogs running around, I always have to say, "Yeah, who let the dogs out?"
There's a person in every group who will make that same comment.
Yeah, I'm that guy.
There will never be a dog running around and someone won't say that.
The problem is if you get two of those people in the same group, they both and they look at each other. Well, it's my line.
It's a showdown. It's an old west showdown. As soon as you come to a little bit of a confrontation there.
Yeah. So that song's not popular anymore, I guess. Brian Adams, Everything I Do It For You. That one is not liked either anymore. You familiar with that one?
That's a good one.
It was, I want to say like the Three Musketeers movie or something. It was in a movie of some kind and very popular. All these, of course, were very popular, but then now people don't like them. Men Without Hats, The Safety Dance from the 80s. That one always confused me in many levels.
I'm pretty sure I've seen the dance, but I can't remember the song right now.
Yeah. I think it's that one that says, you know, we can dance if we want to. We can.
Okay.
You leave your friends behind. Yeah. I remember hearing that on the radio when I was a teenager on like some sort of 80s flashback moment and just being just like the world stopping and me listening and thinking, what are they talking about? What is this about? Is this a real thing or is this a joke? And so that one's not popular anymore either. This other one, of course, I think everyone will agree on Billy Ray Cyrus, Achy Breaky Heart, one of the most hated songs now of all time.
Yeah, that's understandable.
Very understandable, I think. And then this one is, I only actually kind of remember this now because of the commercials. Europe, The Final Countdown. Now it's in those car commercials or insurance commercials.
Yeah, Geico.
Yeah.
When the microwave's counting down in the office.
Yeah. The band's there singing. That's so funny. That's one of the best commercials to me.
It's such a trivial moment, and it's being immortalized by a band playing in the office.
That lady's like kind of getting into it a little bit, and the other guy's just eating his lunch and looking at it. I love that commercial. Oh. It's great. That's, I was thinking about it when I saw it, and I saw the band doing it, and I thought, wow, you know, they at one time they were at the height of music, I suppose, and now you're getting phone calls from Geico, like, hey, could we kind of mock your song? And they're like, oh, sure, how much does it pay? You know, I don't care, whatever it pays, we'll take it.
There was that one where they have Ice-T, whoever that is. I don't even know who that is.
That rapper, yeah.
But he was sitting next to a lemonade stand, and some people would always come up and say, Ice-T?
Right.
Like, it's lemonade, man. I'm selling lemonade here.
It's a good commercial. Yeah. He's come a long way from his street credibility days, I guess. Now he's in commercials.
Kind of a relaxed old man.
Yeah. That is a funny one, too. Here's a couple of interesting stories from the Of Course This Happened segment. You're familiar with that old commercial, Break Me Off a Piece of That Kit Kat Bar? Maybe just take the whole thing. Hunter Jobbins, he's a 19-year-old freshman at Kansas State University in Kansas. He had to make a quick trip to his dorm Sunday to drop off some laundry. It was going to be fast, so he left his Toyota Camry unlocked. He returned, and he found a note in his car, and it said this. Saw Kit Kat in your cup holder. I love Kit Kats, so I checked your door, and it was unlocked. Did not take anything other than the Kit Kat. I am sorry and hungry. They stole his Kit Kat and left him a note.
What a thoughtful robber.
Yeah. So he posted it online, of course, and went viral. And Hershey, the maker of Kit Kat, contacted him and sent him 6,500 Kit Kats. And so he put them all inside of his car, and he just leaves it unlocked for people to come take the Kit Kats out of his car. So he's the Kit Kat guy.
It's just a car full of steamy, melted Kit Kats at some point.
Yeah, in the summertime, you wouldn't want to have those in there. But, yeah, so really interesting that somebody would steal it but then think to write the note. I don't know how I feel about that. I mean, he shouldn't have taken it.
Right.
Could have just sat around and waited for the guy, I guess. And
maybe
like,
just tried to ask.
Can I have that Kit Kat? I'm really hungry.
A very good chance he says no, though.
Yeah, there is. So
most people would say no.
Kind of a strange story, but it shows, I guess, in some ways, the power of the internet. Mm-hmm. You post those things, and people, all of a sudden, you got 6,500 Kit Kats from Hershey's.
What an outstanding gift.
Yeah, I wonder how they settled on 6,500. Like, why not 10,000? Or
I don't know.
It seems like an odd number to send, but who knows? Here's one other story from the Of Course This Happened segment. This is from the Orlando Sentinel. Were you ever afraid of squirrels?
At times. There's a lot of perceptions of squirrels that have rabies.
Yeah.
So those are a little bit scary.
This squirrel went crazy. Squirrel attacks folks at a senior living community. The worker calls 911. It says a little squirrel caused a large commotion at a senior living community on Thursday in the Florida area. The animal attacked someone outside Sterling Court on Alabaster Way about 2:30 p.m., according to the sheriff's office. The person attacked couldn't break free of the squirrel and went inside with the animal. So you can imagine they walk in screaming, the squirrel's biting him. That's when it went wild and started attacking others inside an activity room. So you've got these senior citizens in the activity room minding their own business, and here comes a crazy squirrel, and he's attacking everyone. It's one of those things where it's not funny, but yet at the same time, it is a little bit funny, I guess. It's the 911 caller said it's jumping on people and biting them and scratching them, so we need help. Another person is heard in the background yelling, "I feel lightheaded. I don't feel good." Mm. So there was, I don't know if they were being bitter. That was a general comment. Had nothing to do with the squirrel.
Yeah, this is just a regular day for that person.
They always say that out there in the activity room. So a worker who answered the phone at the facility Thursday told the Orlando Sentinel that those who were injured are doing fine. They don't know what happened to the squirrel.
Still, it's on the loose.
They think they got it out of the building, but they don't know where it is.
Oh, that's good. At least, hopefully, it's out of the building now.
Well, now he's got a taste for man flesh, though.
Yeah,
you gotta get rid of that thing.
I wish it would take a dive at me. I'd punch it straight out of the air.
I'll tell you, when I was in college, the campus that I went to had a park right next to it. And we'd park in the park and then walk over. And there were a lot of squirrels, and they were used to people, so they were not afraid at all. And there'd be groups of them that would kind of start to creep up on you. And there was a time or two I thought, this could turn bad. I mean, what if they decide to get together and get a plan or something? Thankfully, nothing happened, but they can bite you. They can be kind of vicious, I guess.
Yeah, I'm sure they can, especially if they are roaming in packs or they have some sort of a disease. They could get pretty vicious, and I think all it would take is just punt one of them, and all the other ones would learn a lesson.
There was a story years ago where there was a guy driving down the road, and he had his car window down, and he had his arm on the door. And I think it was a hawk of some kind swooped down and latched onto his arm. I don't know, thought it was something they wanted to eat. And so the guy runs into the store, and the thing's still on his arm and flapping around and everything. And it took a while for them to get it off. I think they even had I can't remember what the final result was, but like they had to get, you know, emergency personnel in there. That thing was latched on, you know, and it's not like it can at that point do anything with you, but still, you've got this giant bird on your arm. And so I think about that story sometimes when I have my arm on the window. I'm like, oh, what if a hawk came down here? And so weird things happen like that sometimes. And animals that we don't normally think about or worry about, if they got their mind, in that direction where they wanted to do something like that, what would you do? You know, it'd be hard. Even a little squirrel, they're fast, hard to get a hold of. Not that it would kill you, but, you know, you could get a bite in before you did
that's
something
right.
with it.
Yeah, it shows probably why it's important to try and pay attention at all times, not just wander around not knowing about your surroundings.
I was really hoping in the story that they would have said someone in the background yelled, "Oh, nuts." But that didn't happen. That was my wish.
The squirrel was envisioning everyone's head as a giant nut.
Yeah. Yeah, I had a crazy squirrel, so you got to watch out for. I'm not going to think the same about squirrels again after this story. So keep my eye out for them when they're out there. Some of those interesting things that do happen from time to time. The Trumpet Daily Radio Show with your host Stephen Fleury is coming up here in a little bit on KPCG. He is back after being in Ireland for a little bit. And talks today about the youth, the young people, needing vision, and also talks about the book Mystery of the Ages, which you can get online at thetrumpet.com. Really good program for those familiar with the teachings of Herbert W. Armstrong and those not. Good program for everybody. So make sure you listen for that Trumpet Daily Radio Show with your host, Stephen Fleury. And if you can't catch it live or a live replay, you can always get the archives at kpcg.fm. You're listening to Trumpet Radio Live. I'm Dwight Falk and Grant Turgeon here today. Abraham Blondeau has just stopped in. And how you doing?
Pretty good.
Good. Good to see you. I don't know if you heard some of our earlier stories as you were heading over, but we were talking about some of the worst songs of all time, according to the New York Post, their writers. And one of them was USA for Africa, We Are the World. You remember that song?
Yes, I do, unfortunately.
You don't like that one?
It's not amongst my favorites, you could say. But I'm just glad I never took up a musical career because I could probably fill that list. Assuming that people would have paid money to listen to me.
Yeah, that's right. I should tell them, like, you think these are the worst songs. You should have heard the ones I wrote. That's the thing. To make, like, the all-time worst list, you have to at least be very well known.
So millions of people have to know your songs or else it's irrelevant. No one's going to be able to relate to what you're talking about.
Right. You couldn't write in and be like, oh, I heard this guy one time at a bar singing this one song.
People oh,
like,
okay.
Yeah, who's that? What's that?
Yeah, it'd be a fearful list to see the songs no one's ever heard before.
Right. The worst songs you've never heard before. That'd be a good list, too. Abraham, you got an interesting story for us here. It's from the Weekly Standard. Friendship on the Rocks, the disastrous turn in the U.S.-Philippine relations. Filipino President Rodrigo Duterte, I like saying his name for some reason. Just rolls off the tongue, but he's just a loose cannon, I guess, with some of his comments and the things he says. He's bold, and but in some ways it does highlight just what's going on with the Philippines and the U.S. in general. What does the Weekly Standard have to say about this?
Yeah, this is a really interesting article, and it's written by an American Filipino, Cesar Conda. And he was chief of staff for Mark Rubio, so he's a very knowledgeable man, especially on American-Philippine relationships. And he, in his article, really highlights how dangerous this shift in policy is of the Philippines away from America and towards China. And that's really what Duterte, is that?
Duterte, yes.
Duterte.
Something like that.
There we go. Has a little bit of a French ring to it. that his main policy over the first weeks in office has been basically renouncements of the United States and a pivot towards China. And
yeah, which is really interesting because that's what President Obama wanted to do, right? He talked about the pivot to Asia. Maybe that's what he meant. Like everybody right. that we used to be allies with, they'll pivot to Asia. So successful mission, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. It's there is some pivoting going on, but I'm not sure if it's the right kind of pivots. But this article, he just goes through some really interesting statistics on contrasting China's interest in the Philippines compared to America's. And America they defeated Spain in the Spanish-American War in like 1899. And the Philippines came under America's umbrella in 1904. So it's been a long relationship between the two countries.
Yeah, you've been there, haven't you, to the
yes.
Philippines? Yeah. I've talked to others that have been there, and by all indications, they really love the U.S., like the people do. Did you experience that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm Canadian, but yeah. They assumed I was American. And there was a... Yeah, I mean, any Westerner there, they're just very friendly people anyway.
Yeah.
But they show a lot of gratitude, and really a lot of most of the economic progress in that country is due to American influence and American aid and everything. And there's some great numbers here. So after... one of the major hurricanes in 2013, Typhoon Haiyan in 2013, killed a lot of people in the Philippines.
Philippines
sorry. I taught a class on the Philippines earlier today. So
you got it on your mind.
Getting those confused. But the U.S. contributed $20 million.
Yeah.
China gave $2 million, which is less than IKEA.
Wow.
What IKEA gave to the Philippines. They also have, in the last 30 years, America has given over $700 million to the Philippines. In the same amount of time, China has given $1 million.
Yeah.
So you can see, just in terms of economic relationships, China doesn't really value the Philippines that much. The only value there is that their relation to China and the South China Sea and everything that's going on there.
So what do they think as far as what Duterte is up to? Like, what's his reasoning? Is it just because he sees the shift in power regionally?
Yeah, I think he doesn't discuss this much in that article, but I think you can infer that the major reason this is happening is because of the decisions made by the United States government over the past, especially the past 4 years, in relation to China. Because I've talked to some men who visiting the United States from the Philippines, and just how they're dealing with China, especially on the fishing rights there in the South China Sea, because that's really what the Philippines is concerned about. And the Filipino fishermen, they're trying to compete with these huge Chinese fishing vessels, and the Chinese run over their ships. They push them all the way. They threaten them with violence if they get close to that area, even though it is Filipino water. And so the Filipinos can't do anything about it themselves. They're not really seeing the United States do anything about it either. There's been a very weak showing of the United States, I would say.
Yeah, you know,
that issue.
What's so interesting about all that is there's been so much talk, especially over the last 8 years, about people's rights and human rights, and that trumps all things. But when you look at the way we treat our allies, our traditional allies, we're not concerned about their rights. What about the rights of those fishermen? The rights of those fishermen are only protected by a power that's great enough to protect them, which would be the United States. We haven't done that, as this article brings out, or as the person you were talking to brought out. And then you can look at a lot of nations. Israel, now they're a little more able to kind of stand up for themselves to a point, but they still need us. They still need the United States. And we've totally turned our back on those people. But yet at the same time, you know, talk about the rights of illegal immigrants and the rights of this and the rights of that, and then turn our backs on people that we should be defending their rights.
Yeah, exactly. That's the deep irony in all these foreign policy disasters where we see American allies turning to other nations, even our rivals. And that's because we haven't done anything to protect them, to guarantee their rights, to make sure that they don't fall into an existential threat to their nation. And so they're forced to do these things. That's what we're seeing with Japan, Philippines, and many other countries around the world. They're being forced to turn to other countries because the United States is not asserting itself internationally. And I mean, for these Filipino fishermen, that's their livelihood. If they don't catch fish, their families starve. Mm-hmm. I mean, and for the Philippines, when they see an aggressive China just across the South China Sea there, for them, it is an existential threat. They don't really have an armed forces that can compete with China's aggression. And so for them, it is a matter of livelihood. The amount of money the U.S. sends to the Philippines and to that all of Southeast Asia, if that were to be compromised, it would be a huge shift towards China, and it would just really destroy the Filipinos' livelihoods, everything they've been living in for the past generations. And so there's a lot at stake for the Philippines, but for America, it's so far away, and we don't really see that as a key part of our strategy when really they are.
Well, yeah, leads right up to what I was going to ask you. You know, what would you say to the person that says, yeah, I feel bad for them, but it's not our problem. It doesn't benefit us at all. We got our own issues. Let them fend for themselves. Why are the Philippines strategic to the U.S.?
Well, the main reason is in the Pacific, ever since the end of World War II, America has established a defensive chain of islands in the Pacific against any foe, whether that be China, Russia, or anyone else, really. And those go through the Aleutians south of Alaska, or the Aleutians, I should say. Japan itself is a cornerstone of that, and then the Philippines. And even Taiwan was a part of that for a little while. So that's the defensive perimeter that the U.S. Navy can operate in, and to stop any nation crossing the Pacific to possibly do another Pearl Harbor or attack the west coast of the United States. So if these island, if this island defense chain becomes compromised, it opens the door for specifically China and Russia to even launch offensive operations against the United States in the Pacific Ocean. And so while the Philippines, it's not the most wealthy nation in the world, strategically it is very, very important. And it is a base for the 7th Fleet in the Pacific, where the U.S. has it stationed, to guard the South China Sea, where a third of world trade goes through. And if China gets control of that, they control a third of the world trade. They can call shots. They can tell the United States what to do. I mean, this, there's a lot more at stake here than just the Filipino livelihoods. But that's also an issue that the United States should feel very strongly about as well.
Yeah, we're losing. The United States is losing sea battles all over the place. We're about to lose all those sea gates and those areas. It's really interesting. It'll be interesting to see what how Duterte feels about the next president.
He's been very outspoken, and you can imagine someone like Benjamin Netanyahu maybe being more diplomatic, but probably behind the scenes saying maybe even more strong things than what Duterte is saying in public. That's probably how all of America's allies feel right now. Maybe Israel's not specifically looking to China, but all of these allies are looking to different places because America has just publicly disrespected all of them.
Yeah, it's a good point. I mean, sometimes you get a guy like Duterte who says what people are thinking. You've heard, you know, people say, well, he just says what everyone's thinking. That, and he's kind of doing that.
Donald Trump's doing it right now.
Yeah, and people are starting to respond to that a little bit, so... Yeah, this is an interesting, story there. You can read more about that at the Weekly Standard of Friendship on the Rocks, a disastrous turn in the U.S.-Philippine relations. For those of you that listen to a KPCG fairly often and know about the work here at Herbert W. Armstrong College, you know about archaeology, and I thought you'd find this interesting. This is from listverse.com. There's more information there. We're not going to get into all of it, but it's just 10 archaeological discoveries consistent with biblical passages. So they've got a list of 10 that they think, I don't know that it's an inclusive list. I don't have them all here, just I have a few highlights. And don't have all the info because it would take a while to get into it, but you can look at that at listverse.com. Here's a few of them. They say, from archaeological discoveries, you can prove the biblical flood, which I think we've talked about before, Abraham's genealogy, the existence of the city of Sodom, Samaritan captivity, Assyrian invasion, end of the Babylonian exile, and Herod's palace, just to name a few. It's a pretty interesting list, I thought.
Yeah, I've walked in Herod's palace, assuming that's the one in Caesarea. I believe that's because that's where he built it. I assume that's the one, but I've walked in it when I was in Israel, and there's definitely no denial that that's what it is.
Yeah,
and that's where they think the Apostle Paul was imprisoned for a short time in the Book of Acts, one of the before he went to Rome and everything.
Yeah. So really interesting. You can read, again, more about that at listverse. But we have a lot about archaeology on the trumpet.com. You can go there and find out a lot about it. That we have some videos, too, about some pretty awesome discoveries that we've been involved in there in Jerusalem as well. So a lot of information about that. It's always fun. Well, I don't know if fun's the right word, but I think it is kind of fun when when they do find things that do prove to be consistent with the Bible. And yet there's a pushback against that. That was even talked about on the Trumpet Daily yesterday with Brad McDonald about how there is a pushback against that type of archaeology. And the reason being is then, well, if the Bible's true, then what? Right? Did they have to obey it?
It's almost as fun to just hear the critics try to come up with new outlandish ways that the Bible is still somehow untrue after all of these different proofs have been put out there. They really are grasping at straws to try and say the Bible is not accurate at this point.
Well, absolutely. I mean, you think about all of the very, very entrenched types of thinking, and even, I guess you could say industry, if you want to call education an industry. You know, if they prove the Bible to be correct, where does that leave evolution? Where does that leave some of these mainstays of, you know, educational teachings and academia today? So you can see why there'd be pressure to not jump on board and say, hey, great. So we were always hoping this was true.
Well, and it would affect a lot of politics in the world, too. Because, I mean, one of the biggest political questions of our age is the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And so if people did believe the Bible, and if it was verified to be 100% accurate, then people who didn't believe in the Jewish Bible or the Christian Bible, whatever religion you might be, they would have to at least accept it as a historical document, and that the Jews do have a claim to the Promised Land, especially to Jerusalem. But the funny thing is, with all this archaeology, is that sometimes the Jews are their own worst enemies, because some of the top Jewish archaeologists don't believe that the Bible is actually a historical document, and that archaeology actually doesn't back it up. And so you have some of these Jewish archaeologists who believe in the spirituality of the Bible, like what Passover represents, what all their holy days and big events are in the Bible, what they symbolize, but they don't actually believe that they were real, which is, to me, you can't have one without the other. But that's what they believe. And so it's the foundation for a lot of criticism against Israel and against the Bible itself comes from people who actually even believe in the Bible, because they just shoot themselves in the foot, like their cause, in a way.
Yeah, pretty interesting. But you can check out the rest of that at List Verse. And then, of course, I'd definitely recommend The Trumpet. Lots of great articles and videos and so forth about some really good archaeology there. Grant, you have another story for us today. This is from the New American. Just say no to the feds. Michigan town tells Obama, no Muslim migrants for us. So what are the details?
Well, there's this place called Waterford Township in Michigan, and they actually passed a resolution on Monday that told the federal government not to resettle any refugees from Syria inside their own borders, because inside the township, because they thought that the what do they call that, the program for refugees needed to be significantly reformed. And this writer Selwyn Duke goes on to explain how that is pretty much spot on. And he also says that Waterford Township isn't the first place to say that the feds shouldn't be resettling migrants there. So a lot of different towns are seeing how this could clearly cause some problems in their communities. Germany and Sweden are a couple of clear examples. A place like Sweden, where it's a very small country, but three policemen are quitting their jobs every day because it's a hopeless situation with migrants running in the streets and not respecting the law.
Yeah, well, that's really interesting. Well, this will be interesting to see what happens. I don't know the legalities, if they can make that decision or not. But certainly, I think a lot of towns probably have that same feeling. And if they can see one or two doing it, who knows? Maybe more will do that as well. And I can understand their concern on several levels. I mean, if somebody truly needs help and they truly are a refugee, you would like to see them get some help in some way. But at the same time, if you just open up your doors, you know, a lot of times you can't control it once it comes in there. And I know I've mentioned this before, but growing up, we had some refugees come in, and started out with one family in the 80s. And by the time I left the area in right around 2000, there was 10,000-15,000. And it just kind of took over parts of the, and there was always, you know, it wasn't like what we're seeing today. It wasn't that type level of conflict, but it was different ways of living, different ways of doing things, and it didn't yield good results. All of a sudden you have gang problems. It just was a bad situation, and not nearly as bad as, like, because the migrants that were coming in my personal example there, they were from over in Laos and that area, and they sound like they have a fundamental religion that's against Western culture. They were just kind of doing their own thing. So it was a little bit of a different deal. But here with Syria and terrorism and all this, there's just so many things to be concerned about on top of just the different cultures.
And it's amazing, because this administration here in the U.S. right now continues to downplay all of the potential threats, or even just some of the logistical problems with bringing in all these migrants. It says that really there aren't any Western-style databases that can thoroughly vet migrants before they come over here. And even if there were some thorough databases, it's been proven a lot of times that you can actually just pay off some of those officials over there in Syria or some of these other nations and get whatever official government documents you're looking for, documents that say you are whatever you want to be instead of what you actually are. So it's really difficult to say that these people are safe. And he even quotes a doctor, or I guess a scholar, who is actually a Muslim refugee living in Britain. And this man warned the West by saying, look, these people are trying to stealth jihad whenever they come over to these places. They're trying to take over in a passive way by just becoming the majority in these new areas. You know, eventually that's the goal, is to come into Europe and become the majority, come into America and be the majority. And it's definitely somewhat of a long-term goal, but it's almost like our politicians are helping them every step of the way.
And well, then you have to just even think about the financial side of it. You know, I don't know much about this particular town, but Michigan's had their difficulties with the collapse of the car industry, automotive industry, and other manufacturing. And so they've been struggling. I mean, you see all those videos about Detroit and how bad it is. They've had the water problems in Flint. They've had problems there, and I don't think they can handle more. You know, they got enough problems of their own. Now I got to handle somebody else's problems. That's hard to do, even financially.
Yeah, that's definitely not the best place for migrants right now. They can barely handle what they're dealing with without the migrants coming in. And it's also interesting because this article points out that the five richest Arab nations, which are Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, Kuwait, the United Arab Emirates, and Qatar, have all refused to accept even a single Syrian migrant. They haven't taken in one, and yet we're taking in tens of thousands, eventually hundreds of thousands if Hillary Clinton gets her way. Not a good idea. These people who are neighboring Syria know that it's not a good idea to just bring in people who are potentially dangerous, people who are clearly unstable because of the situations in their region. Yeah, and
No, I was going to say, just financially, you'd think that they would have the resources, too.
Oh, yeah. It should be theoretically easy, and it wouldn't be too difficult for them to just bring some people in and help out. But why would you do that if it is a threat to your own nation?
Right. And so yeah, we would be wise to ask them, like, why don't you want to take these guys? We probably know the answer already.
Well, they should be given first priority. I mean, if before we bring them in, we should say, how about you nations over there maybe help some of your own? I mean, these are fellow Arabs. Why aren't you helping out a brother instead of having us take care of it from afar?
Right. I mean, if it's this big global community that they want to have happen, wouldn't everybody equally help out? It doesn't work that way. It's only talk of global community when it's a policy that will hurt us and help other people.
Yeah, well, that's why the Palestinians exist. Because when Israel became a nation, the Arabs were in some turmoil in the area that were given to the Jews, but no other Arab nation wanted them. The Arabs that were living in the Jewish area under the Balfour Declaration. The Palestinians exist today because of this very problem. They became a semi, not really nation, living inside of Israel because no other Arab nation wanted to give them sanctuary. And those who do live in Arab nations live in these terrible refugee camps inside of these Arab nations. And so it is funny that for decades, the United States has told them, like, well, you can live together. Like, it's you're being rude or inconsiderate towards the Palestinians, you guys can coexist together. And now all of a sudden the kind of tables have turned where America is all of a sudden, oh, we'll take all these immigrants. But now they're starting to realize a bit of the problem there is with that solution. And they're kind of giving, I mean, America is huge compared to Israel. There's no, can't compare those, but we just get a small taste of how difficult it is and that problem Israel has dealt with for their whole existence. And how it doesn't work. We're just starting to see this problem from their perspective for the first time. And we can see all the complications and just the cultural clash that's involved with it.
You know what they should do? This would actually be the big solution here. We'll send them all to the islands in the South China Sea that China keeps making. They're building islands.
Yeah, there's airports.
Put people on them.
Yeah.
Sure, there's all kinds of infrastructure. I think China would be happy to do that.
Seems like a pretty nice solution there. There are some problems with the percentages involved, which is it's estimated about 75% of the migrants coming over from Syria are actually from relatively safe places in the nation, if there are any left. The ones who have truly seen their towns devastated by war don't have the means to transport themselves to a place where they can then be taken to America. They don't have any money. They don't have really any means to get themselves to America in the first place. So really, there isn't even an element of absolute desperation for the people coming here. They're just coming here and they don't really need to. About 75% of them is estimated. And then also, it's estimated that about over 99% of all the ones coming here are Muslims, even though there's a genocide against Christians going on over there. ISIS is taking time out of their battles to kill Christians in the nation. So those are the ones who are in the greatest need. And if they invited people in based on proportion of population, Christians should be at least about 10% of the migrants coming over, not less than 1%.
Right. Yeah. Well, and again, like we've said about some of these other stories, it'll be interesting to see what happens when the new president comes into office. Will the policies continue as they are? Will they change? That'll be a thing everybody's looking to see. And nobody knows. It's a secret. I guess if Hillary Clinton gets in, it'd probably be more of the same. I think we know that. Mm-hmm. Donald Trump, I'm not really sure. Because, like we said, you know, the campaign's been so much about just demonizing the other side. It's like, well, what are your policies, though? What are you going to do? So we don't know.
Well, I think that's going to be interesting, too, if Donald Trump does win, just how his immigration policy will fit into the Constitution and how, like, legally all these changes he promises to the United States, how those will come about, if he'll do it through the Congress and everything, or if he'll use some of the methods employed by President Obama to get
phone
his way on immigration. Yeah.
The phone and the pen.
It's just interesting because the same methods that this liberal administration used to get their way on immigration, Donald Trump could use to get his way on immigration that the liberals don't like.
Yep. It'll be interesting to see. And as a note, next Tuesday evening, we plan to be live with some election coverage for you here on KPCG. So you'll enjoy that. That sounds like a threat. Yeah. You will enjoy that.
You better.
We hope you enjoy that. That'll be interesting.
We should call it elucidating on the election.
I can't say that. I can't enunciate it. Otherwise, I would. That'll do it for us on this edition of Trumpet Radio Live, this weekend edition. We appreciate you being with us today and this week as well. And have a great weekend. Enjoy yourselves. And we'll see you back here next week.
Listening to Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG.